sort of a central characteristic of this person. The story, the anthology or collection of Schwartz's that I'm reading out of is called The Melting Pot and Other Subversive Stories. And the particular story I've chosen to read today is called What I Did for Love. What I Did for Love is a story about death, exploring death in our life, in our society. And I guess you have to listen to it knowing that. I guess I would ask you to listen to it. I want to give the plot away right away. I want to tell you Carl dies. And so then you can kind of listen to his life knowing that that's coming. And I think it'll sort of sharpen your ears. It's hard to hear a story the first time through and get as much out of it as you always want to. So if you know a few things about it ahead of time, sometimes that helps. This story is flat out an exploration of death in our society, but it's not all Carl's death. There are other ways of looking at death through the story. And it's also the main character, who is the narrator, is a humorous person. She's got a sense of humor. So she does it with a kind of grace and style and impatience and lots of the feelings that people would feel about death, but she does it with a nice kind of spin on it that makes it fun. Because I want to have a little more discussion time than we could have if I read every word, I'm going to leave out a few words here and there, and when I do that, I'll summarize quickly. And I think the parts that I'm going to leave out won't distort or change the story for you. So we'll read the story and then talk about it, and it'll be really fun for me to hear what you have to say. I'm anticipating your feedback. What I Did for Love by Lynn Sharon Schwartz. I always think it's important how a story begins. The first word in the story is together, and the first phrase is together with Carl. Carl's her husband. And the first longer phrase is, together with Carl, I used to dream. So that's all real sort of significant, because those are all themes that get played through the whole story. Together with Carl, I used to dream of changing the power structure and making the world a better place. Never that I would end up watching the 10 o'clock news with a small rodent on my lap. He was the fourth. Percy, the first, was a bullet-shaped, dark brown guinea pig, short-haired as distinct from the long-haired kind, and from the moment he arrived, he tried to hide, making tunnels out of the newspapers in his cage, until Martine, who was just eight then, cut the narrow ends off a shoebox and made him a real tunnel, where he stayed except when food appeared. I guess she would have preferred a more sociable pet, but Carl and I couldn't walk a dog four times a day, and the cat we tried chewed at the plants and watched us in bed, which made us self-conscious, and finally got locked in the refrigerator as the magnetic door was closing. So after we found it chilled and traumatized, we gave it to a friend who appreciated cats. Percy had been living his hermit life for about a year when Martine noticed he was hardly eating and being unusually quiet. No rustling of paper in the tunnel. I made an appointment with a vet someone recommended. On the morning of the appointment, after I got Martine on the school bus, I saw Percy lying very still outside the tunnel. I called the vet before I left for work to say I thought his patient might be dead. Might be? Well, how can I tell for sure? He clears his throat as if, and with his patronizing air doctors have, even vets, and says, why not go and flick your finger near the animal's neck and see if he responds? Since I work for a doctor, I'm not intimidated by this attitude. It just rolls off me. Okay, hold on a minute. I went and flicked. He doesn't seem to respond, but still, I just don't feel sure. Raise one of his legs, he said slowly, as if he's talking to a severely retarded person. Wiggle it around and see if it feels stiff. He never heard of denial, this guy. What am I going to tell Martine? Hang on, I say. I wiggle the leg. It feels stiff, I had to admit. I think it's safe to assume, he says, that the animal is dead. I guess we won't be keeping the appointment then? I'm not retarded. I said it on purpose to kind of rile him and see what he'd say. that will hardly be necessary. To get ready for the burial, I put Percy in a shoebox, a new one, not the tunnel one, wrapped the tissue paper from the shoes around him, and added some flowers I bought on the way home from work, then sealed it up with masking tape. Carl and I kept the coffin in our room that night so Martine wouldn't have to be alone in the dark with it. She didn't cry much, at least in front of us. She keeps her feelings to herself, more like me in that way than Carl. But I knew she was very attached to Percy, hermit that he was. The next morning, a Saturday, the three of us set out carrying the box and a spade and shovel we borrowed from the super of the building. Carl's plan was to bury him in the park. But it was in the dead of winter, February, and the ground was so frozen the spade would barely break it. "This isn't going to work," he said. Martine looked tragic. She's always been a very beautiful child, with a creamy-skinned face and an expression of serene, tragic beauty that, depending on the situation, can make you want to laugh or cry. At that moment, I could have done either. We were huddled together, our eyes and noses running from the cold, Martine clutching the shoebox in her blue-down mittens. "I know what," Carl said. "We'll bury him at sea." Martine's face got even more tragic, and I gave him a funny look, too. What sea? It was more than an hour's drive to Coney Island, and I had a million things to do that day. "The river. It's a very old and dignified tradition," he told her, "for people who die on ships when it would take too long to reach land. In a way, it's nicer than an earth burial. In the course of time, Percy's body will drift to the depths and mingle with a coral and anemone instead of being confined in..." "Okay," she said. So we walked up to the 125th Street Pier on the Hudson River. This is a desolate place just off an exit on the West Side Highway where the only buildings are meat processing plants and where in the daytime a few lone people come to wash their cars, hauling water up in buckets and even to fish, believe it or not. And at night, people come to buy and sell drugs. I looked at Martine. She handed me the box like she couldn't bear to do it herself, so I knelt down and placed it in the river as gently as I could. I was hoping it would float for a while, at least till we could get her away. But my romantic Carl was saying something poetic and sentimental about death, and it began to sink, about 4 feet from where we stood. It was headed south, though, towards the Statue of Liberty and the open sea, I pointed out to her, free at last. We got her another guinea pig, a chubby, buff-colored one who did not hide and was intelligent and interested in its surroundings as much as a guinea pig can be. We must have had it, Mooney it was called, for around a year and a half when Carl began talking about changing his life, finding a new direction. He was one of those people, we both were, who had dropped out of school because it seemed there was so much we should be doing in the world. I was afraid he would be drafted, but we had long searching talks, the way you do when you're 20, about whether he should be a conscientious objector. But at the last minute, the Army didn't want him because he had flat feet and was partially deaf in one ear. Those same flat feet led all those marches and demonstrations. Anyhow, he never managed to drop back in later on when things changed. Not that there was any less to do, but somehow no way of doing it anymore and hardly anyone left to do it with, not to mention money. You have to take care of your own life, we discovered. And if you have a kid, you find yourself doing things you had never planned on. He started driving a cab when Martine was born and had been ever since. I'm going to leave out a bit here which talks about his driving a cab and that to her means at least that he's going places, traveling, meeting people. And then she says that she's an x-ray technician, which of course means that she sees inside of people. And then he says that what he really wants to be is go into the art of topiary, which I take her topiary, T-O-P-I-A-R-Y, which means that he wants to study fancy landscaping, growing things. But then he says, but he would be glad to settle for having a plant store, and says that it seems a little embarrassing. And she says, why should that be embarrassing? Well, when you first met me, I was going to alter the power structure of society. And now I'm telling you I want to have a plant store. Are you laughing at me, Chris? Tell the truth. I haven't heard you say anything laughable yet. I didn't really expect you to change the world, Carl. No? I mean, I believed you meant it. and I believed in you, but that's not why I married you. Lord, no. I married him for his touch, it struck me, and the sound of his voice, and a thousand of those other things I thought I couldn't exist without. It also struck me that I had never truly expected to change the power structure, but that I had liked hanging out with people who thought they could. It was, I would have to say, inspired. Do you think I'm having a midlife crisis? No, you're only 33. I think you want to change jobs. So we decided he should try it. And then they go on and say he got a job in a plant store, but he continued driving the cab at night. And they saved some money so that Martine, their daughter, could go to camp, summer camp, with some sort of hippies or progressive types or people like they had been when they dropped out of school to change the world. And Martine, who was named after Martin Luther King, goes to camp and brings her guinea pig Mooney, and Mooney dies at camp. He gets torn apart by a raccoon or something. And the camp, because they're nice people, buy her another guinea pig. We're on number three now. This one's name is Percy. In the dead of winter, even colder than in Percy's era, Martine told us Elf. No, this one's name is Elf, sorry. Elf wasn't eating. Oh no, I thought, deja vu. The stillness, then the stiffness, wrapping it in the shoebox, burial at sea. Nevertheless, what can you do? So I made an appointment with a vet, the same old arrogant vet. I didn't have the energy to look for a new one. I was feeling sick when the day arrived, so Carl took off from work and went with Martine and Elf. There's good news and bad news, he said when they got home. The good news is that she doesn't have a dread disease. What's wrong with her is her teeth. I was lying in bed trying to sleep. Her teeth? You've got it. Her top and bottom teeth are growing together, so she can't eat. She can't separate them to chew. He gave him a demonstration of Elf's problem, stretching his lips and straining his molars. Please, this is no time to make me laugh. My stomach is killing me. What is it, your period? No, I don't know what. Well, listen, the bad news is that she needs surgery, oral surgery. It's 125, including the anesthetic. That is not the least bit funny. What are we going to do? Martine was putting Elf back in her cage, otherwise we would have discussed this with more sensitivity. Is there a choice? You know how Martine feels. Albert Schweitzer Jr. I made an appointment for tomorrow. She'll have to stay overnight. I presume you mean Elf, not Martine. Of course I mean Elf. Maybe I should call a doctor for you, too. No, I'll be okay. What's a stomach ache compared to oral surgery? I don't want you getting all worked up over this, Chris. He joined me on the bed and started fooling around. Thousands of people each year have successful oral surgery. It's nothing to be alarmed about. I'll try to deal with it. Ow, you're leaning right where it hurts. Martine came into the room and Carl sat up quickly. She's looking very wan, she said. 2 days from now, she'll be a new person, Carl said. She's never been a person before. How could she be one in 2 days? Medical science is amazing. I have no luck with guinea pigs. She plopped into a chair, stretching out her legs, and sat gazing at her sneakers. I noticed how tall she was growing. She was nearly 12 and beginning to get breasts. But she wasn't awkward like most girls at that stage. She was stunning, willowy, and auburn-haired with green eyes. There was sometimes a faint emerald light in the whites of her eyes that would take me by surprise, and I would stare and think, what a lucky accident. Maybe none of them live long, I said. I doubt if yours are being singled out. They have a 4 to 6 year lifespan. I looked it up in the encyclopedia. But in 4 years, I've gone through almost three. That night, I had such terrible pains in my stomach that Carl took me to the emergency room, where after a lot of fussing around, they tried to send me home, they tried to get me to sleep. They found out it was my appendix, and it had to come out right away. It was quite a few days before I felt like anything resembling normal, and I completely forgot about Elf's oral surgery. Chris, before we go inside, I better tell you something. Carl switched off the engine and reached into the back seat for my overnight bag. He was avoiding my eyes. What happened? I spoke to her on the phone just last night. I was about to leap out of the car, but he grabbed my arm. Hold it a minute, will you? You're supposed to take it easy. Well, what's wrong, for Christ's sake? He looked at me. Not Martine. Jesus. Elf. Elf? I thought I would pass out. I was still pretty drugged. She got through the surgery all right. We brought her home the next day, but I don't know whether she was too weak from not eating or what, but she never started eating again, and so... I never liked that doctor. How did Martine take it this time? Sad, but philosophical. I think she's used to it by now. Besides, she was more concerned about you. Well, I'm glad to hear that. So where is the corpse? At sea again? Well, no, actually. That's what I wanted to tell you, before we went into the apartment. The temperature has been near zero. The river is frozen. Just give it to me straight, Carl. She's wrapped in some plastic bags on the bathroom windowsill, outside. The iron grating's holding her in place. I was just going to put her in the freezer with meat, but I thought you might not care about that. Couldn't you find a shoebox? No, I guess nobody's gotten new shoes lately. And how long is she going to stay there? They're predicting a thaw. It's supposed to get warm, unseasonably warm. So in a few days, we'll take her out to the park. Anyway, welcome home. Oh, there's another thing. I hope this is good. It was. He found a job working in the greenhouse at the Botanical Garden. Since Martine never brought the subject up again after the thaw and the park burial, I assumed the guinea pig phase of her life was over. 2 weeks after she returned from camp that summer, the super who had loaned us the spade and shovel for Percy came up to say there was a family in the next building with a new guinea pig, but their baby was allergic to it and couldn't stop sneezing. Maybe we wanted to do them a favor and take it off their hands. Martine and I turned to each other. What do you think? I said. I'm not sure. They're a lot of expense, aren't they? Not so bad. I mean, with a little lettuce, carrots. The medical expense. And you don't like them too much, do you, Mom? You don't like to handle them. You don't like small rodents, said Martine. And then she shrugs that off and says, oh, I'm fine, I can handle them. And Martine says, I know you don't like to handle them. I'll take care of it. And she goes over and looks at the guinea pig and accepts it, and now they have another guinea pig. I didn't pay any more attention to Rusty, named for his color, than I had to the others. I made sure to be in another room while Martine and Carl cut his nails, one holding him down, the other clipping. They took turns. Martine started junior high and got even more beautiful, breasts, hips, the works, with a kind of slow way of turning her head and moving her eyes. She also started expressing intelligent opinions on every subject in the news: test tube babies, airplane hijackings, chemicals in packaged foods. While Carl and I listened and marveled with this peculiar guilty relief that she was turning out so well. I guess because we were not living out our former ideals, not changing the world, or, on the other hand, being particularly upwardly mobile either. Carl was happier working in the greenhouse, but we still hadn't managed to save enough to rent a store or qualify for a bank loan. At Martine's 13th birthday party in May, we got to talking in the kitchen with one of the mothers who came to pick up her kid. I liked her. She was about our age, small and blonde, and she had dropped out of school too, but had gone back to finish and was even doing graduate work. What field? I asked. I was scraping pizza crusts into the garbage while Carl washed out soda cans. He was very big on recycling. In the living room, the kids were dancing to a reggae song called Free Nelson Mandela. And the three of us had been remarking, first of all, that Nelson Mandela had been in prison since we were about their age. And in the meantime, we had grown up and we were raising children and feeling vaguely disappointed with ourselves. And secondly, that dancing to a record like that wouldn't have been our style, even if there had been one back then, which was unlikely. Singing was more our style. And the fact that teenagers today were dancing to this Free Nelson Mandela record at parties made their generation seem less serious. Yet at this point, who are we to judge styles of being serious? The man was still in prison, after all. Romance languages, she said. She was playing with the plastic magnetic letters on the refrigerator. They had been there since Martine was two. Sometimes we would use them to write things like Merry Xmas or, as tonight, Happy Birthday.
and sometimes to leave real messages like skating back at 7 a.m. The messages would stay up for the longest time, eroding little by little because we knocked the letters off accidentally and stuck them back in any old place, or because we needed a letter for a new message so that happy birthday could come to read Happa Birde. And at some point, they would lose their meaning altogether, like Hey Erda, which amused Martine no end. This woman wrote, Nel mezzo del cammin di nostra vita. What does that mean? Carl asked her. It means, in the middle of the journey of our life. It's the opening of the divine comedy. What it means is, here I am, 35 years old, and I'm a graduate student. There's nothing wrong with that, said Carl. I admire your determination. I'm driving a cab. But one day, before I die, I'm going to learn to do topiary for the simple reason that I want to. She said what I knew she would. What's topiary? He stopped rinsing cans to tell her. I never read the Divine Comedy, but I do know Dante goes through hell and purgatory and eventually gets to paradise. All the parts you ever hear about, though, seem to take place in hell, so that a small shiver ran up my spine seeing that message on the refrigerator above Happy Birthday. Then I forgot about it. In bed that night, I asked Carl if he was serious about learning topiary. He said that he'd been thinking it over again. Since he'd gotten a raise at the greenhouse, maybe he might give up the cab altogether. He was so sick of it. And use the money we'd save for the store to study landscape gardening. Well, okay, that sounds good. I can work a half day Saturdays, maybe. No, I don't want you to lose the little free time you have. We'll manage. Maybe there's something you want to go back and study, too. I'm not ambitious. Why would I be more attractive, like, if I went to graduate school? Ha! Did I hear you right? He let out a comic whoop. I don't even remember her name, Chris. Listen, you want me to prove my love? That was the last time. The next day, he came down with a flu, then Martine and I got it, and just when we were beginning to come back to life, he had a heart attack driving the cab. He might have made it, the doctor said, except he was alone and lost control of the wheel. They told me more details about it, just like a news report, than I could bear to listen to, in fact. I tried to forget the words at the minute I heard them, but no amount of trying could make me stop seeing the scene in my mind. They offered me pills all through those next insane days, but I wasn't interested in feeling better. Anyhow, what kind of goddamn pill could cure this? I asked them. I also kept seeing in my mind a scene on the Long Island Expressway when Martine was a baby and we were going to Jones Beach. About three cars ahead of us, over in the right lane, a car started to veer, and as we got closer, we could see the driver slumping down in his seat. Before we could even think what to do, a state trooper appeared out of nowhere and jumped in on the driver's side to grab the wheel. Sirens started up. I guess they took him to the hospital and a huge pileup was averted. Watching it, I felt bad about how we used to call cops pigs. That sounds a little simple-minded, I know, but so was calling them pigs. And now I wondered, how come a miracle in the form of a cop happened for that person and not for Carl? Which is a question a retarded person might ask. I mean, an out-of-the-way street in Queens at 11 at night. It happened the way it happened, that's all. A loss to all those who might have enjoyed his topiary. I do think he would have done it in his own good time. If only we'd had a little more time, I could have taken care of him. I wouldn't have been a miracle, but I would have done a good job. The way he vanished, though, I couldn't do a thing, not even say goodbye or hold his hand in the hospital or whatever it is old couples do. Maybe the wife whispers that she'll be joining him soon, but I have no illusions that I'll ever be joining him, soon or late. I just got a lot less of him than I expected. Another thing is that the last time we made love, I was slightly distracted because of the graduate student he admired for her determination. Not that anything transpired between them except some ordinary conversation, but it started me wondering in general. Stupid, because I know very well how he felt. He told me every night. Those words I don't forget. I let them put me to sleep. I lie there, remembering how it felt with his arms and legs flung over me. And I can't believe I'm expected to get through decades without ever feeling that again. So I did end up working half days on Saturdays. In July, Martine was supposed to go back to camp, to the camp run by the progressives and pacifists where she had always had such a great time except for her tragedy with Mooney, and I didn't want to begin my life alone by asking for help. I don't have to go, she said. If we don't have the money, it's all right. I don't think I even feel like going anymore. My beautiful child with a tragic face. Now she had something worthy of that face. You should go, however you feel. When you get there, you'll be glad. Except there's a slight problem, she said. What's that? Rusty. I'm not taking him, not after what happened to Mooney. No, I agreed. Which means... Oh, God. All right, I can do it. How bad can it be? A little lettuce, cabbage, right? A few handfuls of pellets? There's the cage to clean, too. The cage, okay. It was hard, her going off on the bus, with a typical scene of cheery mothers and fathers crowding around waving brown lunch bags, but I forced myself through it, and so did she. I would force myself through the rest of my life if I had to. First thing every morning, and before I went to bed, I put a handful of pellets in Rusty's bowl and fresh water in his bottle, and when I left for work and came home, I dropped a few leaves of something green into the cage. Since I never really looked at him, I was shocked the fourth night after Martine left, when Mr. Coates, who had come up to fix the window lock in her room, said in his usual unexcited way, "Your pig's eye's popping out." The right eye was protruding half an inch out of the socket, and the cylindrical part behind it was yellow with gummy pus, a disgusting sight. "Jesus F. Christ," I said. I want to stop there and say that if you noticed where she swears and where she uses Jesus or Christ, it's always significant, I think. He won't be no help to you. You need a vet, said Mr. Coates. The thought of going back to that arrogant vet who I always suspected had screwed up with Elf was more than I could take, so I searched the yellow pages till I found a woman vet in the neighborhood. When I walked in the next day carrying Rusty in a carton, I knew I had lucked out. She had curly hair like a mop, she wore jeans and a white sweatshirt, and she seemed young, maybe 29 or 30. Her name was Dr. Dunn. Very good, Dr. Dunn, so there won't be all that other shit to cope with. To get him on the examining table, I had to lift him up by his middle and feel all the squirminess and the beat of his scared, delicate heart between my palms. It looks like either a growth or some of some kind pushing it forward, or maybe an abscess. But in either case, I'm afraid the eye will have to go. It's badly infected, and unless it's removed, it'll dry up and the infection will spread and, he'll die? Right. $75, she said, including his overnight stay, plus $25 for the biopsy. Terrific, I thought, just what I need. It was lower than the other vets' rates, though. I want to explain something about the surgery. He's a very small animal, 2 pounds or so, and any prolonged anesthesia is going to be risky. What that means is I can't make any guarantees. I'd say his chances are 70-30, depending on his general condition. Of course, we'll do everything we can. And if I don't do it, he'll die anyhow? Right. Squirming there on the table was this orange rat whose fate I was deciding. I felt very out of sync with reality, as if I was in a science fiction movie. How did I ever arrive at this place? Okay, I guess we better do it. The receptionist I left him with told me to call around 4 the next day to see how he came through the surgery. If was what she meant. That evening, out of habit, I almost went in to toss him some celery, and then I remembered the cage was empty. There was no reason to go into Martine's room, but I decided to take the opportunity to clean the cage and the room both. I had found that the more I moved around, the more numb I felt, which was what I wanted. On the dot of 4, I called from work. Dr. Dunn answered herself. He's fine. What a trooper, that Rusty. We had him hooked up on the EKG the whole time and monitored him, and he was terrific. I'm really pleased. Thank you, I managed to say. Thank you very much. In one day, she had established a closer relationship with him than I had in a year. That was an interesting thought. I mean, it didn't make me feel emotionally inadequate. I simply realized that's why she went through years of vet school, because she really cared, the way Carl could have about topiary, I guess. Can you come and pick him up before 7? then I can tell you about the post-op care. Post-op care. I had never thought of that. So then she goes on at some length about the post-op care, which is quite elaborate, and she has to do many things to care for this thing. When I went to get some ice water for the cold compress that night, I saw the message the graduate student mother had left on the refrigerator near Happy Birthday, which was now Half Birthday. Ni mes y el cam de Nester Vida, it read. I knew some letters were missing, though not which ones, and those that were left were crooked, but I remembered well enough what it meant. Here I am in the middle of life, I think it was, or something like that. I sat down to watch the 10 o'clock news with Rusty on.
The first one is treated rather comically with the burial and this sort of thing, and with Carl being the main humorist along those lines, and she being more frustrated with the whole exercise. The second one, being frustrated with the bed, with the expense, with everything that goes on, but Carl being the one who is saying, you know, we have to do this because of our daughter. Then here, his death comes, and it's treated very, I don't think casually, but with a sense of, a huge sense of grief that is not manifested in the writing, but then is expressed with the following nurturing that she does for that last guinea pig. And so to me it seems that it's, you know, it's not a love of guinea pigs. It's a fight against death. It's a battle against loss once more. Mm-hmm. And the contrast for taking care of a guinea pig, which is expressed by this vet, that how much when one loses someone who means so much to them, how much is even the little death or a little loss. And when something goes wrong and you're not able to have control over it, how hard you fight for that after you lose something of great significance, even the littlest thing, hold the greatest significance, and how much you try to work against that. I think that was the contrast with these. And that's why I think it was great that she used guinea pigs. It's, you know, much better than a dog or anything else. It's just a, you know, an animal that's not highly regarded on our pet scale.
What is the commonplace phrase about guinea pigs?
Oh, yeah, did she call them rats all the time? Yellow rats.
Or pigs. She calls them pigs.
Or pigs, but she also said, but it is a guinea pig, and when you say about yourself, I was a guinea pig. Mm-hmm. A guinea pig is someone that we experiment on. We try out things. We, you know, it's the classic animal to use as an experiment, to try out and experiment on. That's what she's got there, is a guinea pig. She says, finally I tried patting him and talking to him like a baby to quiet him when she's trying to minister to this guinea pig. Don't worry, kiddo, you're going to be all right. Stuff like that, the way Carl would have done without feeling idiotic. It worked. Only hearing those words loosened me a little out of my numbness, and I had this terrible sensation of walking a tightrope in pitch darkness, though in fact I was whispering sweet nothings to a guinea pig. Then she said, I even thought of telling him what I'd been through with my appendix, a fellow sufferer, and God knows what next, but I controlled myself. If I freaked out, who would take care of Martine? So she's really struggling to maintain some control on herself because she's afraid if she let go that she would become useless to Martine. She doesn't want to feel. She wants to be controlling it. She wants to put a lid on it. And as soon as she let any tenderness toward anything come out of her, she felt this terrible fear that she was going to just lose it.
But yet wasn't there an element of life being precious when you were reading about her whole feeling a little heartbeat? Mm-hmm. I sort of had a feeling that mm-hmm. even though it was a little tiny life, there was a valuing of it.
Mm-hmm. And when she talked about the plants, and her whole, it seemed like her whole life at that point was a struggle to keep things alive, a losing battle, but a, you know, three plants had already died. And
the fact that there's quite a bit of mention made of her and Carl's younger life when they were social activists and so forth, and she talked about Carl recycling, and so she had that background of life is precious to undergird her, even though she didn't particularly love guinea pigs.
Right. It's interesting because she talked a lot about what life means. Mm-hmm. What is life? I mean, this story is an exploration of death, but it's also an exploration of the meaning of life, I think. And she does tell us a lot about what she thinks the meaning of life is, I think, particularly before Carl's death. Anything come to mind there? She talks about, at one point, why did she marry Carl? She married because he was going to save the world. No, simple things like how he sounded and the way he touched her, and you know, she liked him, but not because he was going to save the world. And she talks about fairly often about values in life. It seems to me about the value of coming to your senses when you're a couple of young hippies, when you've got a kid. You know, you got to get regular. You have to get a regular life. So then you get regular somehow. And she talked about the importance of him getting a better job and getting out of driving a cab. Do you think his life was wasted because he never succeeded in quitting driving a taxi? Was his life, was it a disappointment in the end? Does she imply that if only he'd gotten out of taxi driving, he would have been complete in his life or something? When are you going to...
I don't think so. At all.
The dreams seemed important.
Mm-hmm.
The planning and the kind of being partners, working toward fruition of those dreams, you know, working out their stuff. Step by step, moving him toward topiary, you know, getting a job in a plant store, and him coming back at her, I don't want you to give up your Saturdays, you know, you need your time, and would you like to go back to school? I mean, I think the quality of their life was pretty rich.
Mm-hmm.
Between them, they lived in an apartment in a building with a super in New York City with no place to, I mean, it wasn't a dream life according to a lot of our standards of what a dream life is, but boy, I think it sounded real nice.
But that's a commentary on the legacy of death, though, I think, as well, for those who continue to live, is to look at the life of the loved one and see if it was a life that was a fulfilled life. And dreams that are not, you know, dreams that are present but maybe not fulfilled can sometimes be painful as well. And I think she refers to that towards the end again. Can't remember exactly, but she brought that up again as far as those dreams in relation to Carl. Not that his life wasn't fulfilled, but part of the legacy is always the question.
I think along those same lines, she did touch the idea that when we lose a loved one, that life isn't fair. She talked about, had there been a cop that jumped in her husband's car, you know, that he would be there today. So she did touch on that, and I think all people who lose someone say, you know, it isn't fair that my loved one died and somebody else's loved one, you know, perished. King Lear, when his daughter dies in the play, is saying, why is a dog alive, a cat alive, and not my loved one alive? And she went through, you know, some of that. But life, you know, life isn't fair. Now this little guinea pig is alive, but my husband isn't. Well, she didn't say that, I think.
Mm-hmm. And she tried to do some bargaining, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would have taken care of him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Give me another chance.
Which I think is familiar. I mean, those of you who've gone through a death of a loved one, you know those feelings. And you probably also know the feeling of getting enough control. She talks about the first weeks after he died as just being times when they wanted her to take drugs and she was resentful. She said, a pill is going to make this better? You know, give me a break. I don't want to feel better. You know, like a pill would disguise her feelings or give her, I think, some hostility and anger. But then And that time sounds like it was pretty out of control, which is appropriate, I would think. But then when she gets control, she wants to keep it. She really wants, she just feels like she's, she says, I'll force myself through, when she goes through the ritual at the bus of saying goodbye to her kid, and she's a single mom saying goodbye to her kid, and there's all these fathers and mothers there. And she said, we'll both force ourselves to go through these rituals for the rest of our lives if we have to. And I'm going to force myself to go through the rest of my life. She's resigned and committed, and but miserable. I mean, I think she really...
But then she realizes later on that she's going to adjust. And that's, I think, a frightening experience and maybe a... not content, but a comforting thought that someday it will... She will adjust, it'll get better. So it'll be, she's frightened of that, and yet it will be comforting too.
And
she doesn't want to forget it.
Schwartz puts an analogy in here for that. Remember what that is? What's all that talk about the animal learning to find its food after it's one-eyed? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he goes on about how, she said, yes, they adapt quickly. They compensate. She talked about evolution. And why eyes were located where they were. You know, and you realize that this woman is going to adapt and compensate too, that that's all part of life, and that
life will never be the same, but...
And she feels the loss. Why is her why does she say her daughter's lucky in that regard, and she's not? Remember?
She'll always have
She'll only have one father.
Does that mean she thinks she's going to remarry?
Yeah. And she says, I'll remember him eventually as having been the man I had when I was young.
Yeah.
But there'll be other men, is the implication. Mm-hmm. But for my daughter, there will have only been one father. And she thinks, does she feel like it's dishonoring his memory, or there's some loss. She seems to feel some loss there at that. Sense that she's going to evolve, she's going to compensate, she's going to get into a different place where his loss is less painful to her.
I think maybe for me the key there is how she felt about the woman he'd gone back to graduate school. It sort of ended with her seeing those letters. She was in the middle of her life. She wasn't at the end. Sort of a looking toward a new beginning for herself, different, and that would tie in with her daughter. Her daughter will always have that. I'm going to move on. Mm-hmm. That seemed really important to her because it was a point of contention with her husband. Did he admire that woman for having done it to him? And then it sort of came back to it again when she was looking in the refrigerator for the letters.
What about those letters on the refrigerator?
I know, lots of things. And life was sort of meaningless. You know, you take little pieces out of it and how you make sense out of it then, like the happy birthday. And yet she said, I know what the words are, even though they're garbled.
And you take words out of happy birthday, or you take letters out of happy birthday and create new words for a more relevant current time, mm-hmm. back at 7. So out of the past events that were worth noting in those plastic letters on the refrigerator, you create new meaning for your current stuff. And it's constantly evolving so that those words, and our refrigerator is the same way. I mean, our children have been long past the right age to have letters on the refrigerator. But for some reason, we keep them there. And it's the same way. We evolve words down the refrigerator and change. It's like meaning is defined by the current word on the refrigerator. But the current word is sometimes a month old or something, mm-hmm. 2 months old. And so then you have to refocus and redefine the current meaning because life has come along since then. Life's made progress. Or death has made progress. Given the fact that they were Jewish, how did you react to, I guess it isn't important that they're Jewish. I know they are because I know these other stories in this book, but how did you react to her cursing using Jesus and Christ as curse words when at certain times in her life. Did anybody have a reaction
along
to that?
With that, why would she write Merry Christmas on a refrigerator? If it doesn't say the family is Jewish.
Mm-hmm. No, and Carl may not be. And her name is Chris, which is often Christ or some, you know, I mean, symbolically, if you name the character Chris in your book, you're sort of...
Well, I assumed that the profanity and so forth was something that had gone, something that she either picked up or had accepted when they were perhaps younger hippies or whatever, that it was just a habit. She may not have thought much about it.
But it was a habit that she trotted out when she was under stress.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And out of control. She just felt everything was falling apart and she didn't do anything about it.
Is that so uncommon though? I mean...
No, it isn't. We all do it.
Yeah.
But it did really pop out at me somehow. Mm-hmm. It seemed like it was...
Yeah. You don't expect it, then it's there.
Yeah. But she does say she has no expectation of joining him later. She doesn't have a faith that says we're all going to be together in heaven.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and when she uses those words, the super says, well, Jesus isn't going to help you now. You know, what you need now is a vet. Mm-hmm. So there is a sort of a secular, deliberately or almost militantly secular point that she wants to be making. But there's something about it that doesn't succeed. I mean, it's almost like she's, I don't know, you can't, the story doesn't go so far as to say that she's going to find a faith or she's looking for a faith or there's something religious going on there, but I think she's looking for some deeper meaning or something. I mean, I just had the feeling that because that popped out at me so many times, that it meant something, that Schwartz put it in there on purpose. I don't know exactly what
it is. Is she a person of faith, the author?
I don't know. She's really a good writer, and I've just discovered her this summer. She's got at least 7 books out. But I don't know much about that. I don't know anything about it. There's nothing really about her here. I thought that there was some, along those lines, there was something about being a faithful servant that was going on here, too, that just on the literal level, she said, I'm going to keep this guinea pig alive, and I'm going to do whatever it takes to keep it alive, and I'm going to be a faithful servant for my daughter, for the guinea pig, for my own healing, for whatever reasons. But she was determined to come through, even though it was the work she hated the most. I skipped a portion about her care of the guinea pig, but she recoiled when she had to feed it, and when she really didn't like it at all. And there's also something about vocation there. The whole story is an exploration of what life's vocation is. If your life is summed up by your meaningful work in some way, their vocation was to love one another. And the title of the book is What I Did for Love. And there was a real strong theme of loving one another, I think, throughout it. They were consistently loving with each other in very meaningful ways, I think. The husband and wife and the parents and children, all three of them, it was a very loving, faithful family to each other. So, you know, that's, for us, I guess that feels religious in some sense. It feels faithful in some sense. So there's some kind of religious undertone to this thing. It's sort of a nice addition.
What did it mean to you when she mentioned her daughter at least twice as being, you know, very good looking and apparently very physically satisfying to the mother, where I don't remember there was any physical description of either Carl or her. You know, you got their personalities, but you didn't get a physical description.
Yeah, I don't know. Those of you who are parents, does that ring true as a way of looking at life? Sometimes you tend to focus on your kids more.
Yeah. Well, maybe she was just seeing that this was a normal, healthy thing that was going on, no matter what else was going on in her life. That it was progressing and evolving.
Yeah. They were very into growing things. Carl was into growing things for a vocation, and she, they both were into raising that daughter.
I think sometimes, too, when you have those dreams in your 20s,